Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. Let's go to the show. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments concerning COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I guess we'll start with political news this morning. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices is set to meet this Wednesday. And in advance of the meeting, the New York Times has gotten its hand on a confidential copy of a report produced by the Immunization Work Group that appears to cite some push-pulls conducted by anti-vaccine groups to suggest there is an extremely widespread level of vaccine injury owing to COVID-19, and recommends some level of reforms in how U.S. agencies conduct themselves around the vaccines. I'm not all up on all of the technical points the report is discussing, so I'm not quite sure what the import or the consequences of its recommendations are. Could you walk us through them?
I can. I've only had a chance to peruse the article. I haven't had a chance to really look at it in depth. But frankly, perusing it may be absolutely sufficient. This was put together in a very hurried fashion, as you mentioned, by a subgroup of the ACIP, the group that advises the CDC. It used polling from a right-wing polling company to talk to a little over 1,000, I believe, people who claim that they know somebody who had problems with the vaccine. And they're saying that this represents 24% of all the people who got the vaccine. This is what they're calling science. They cherry-picked data from articles and took them out of context. And this is what they're calling science. In contrast to what this article, not peer-reviewed article, reviewed only by the handpicked ACIP subgroup, but in contrast to that, we've had, I can't count how many peer-reviewed papers published on the consequences of getting the mRNA vaccines, or COVID vaccines in general, given to now hundreds of millions of people on this planet. The peer-reviewed articles that we've looked at and seen over the last 5.5 years now, have shown very different information. That is, while any vaccine can have complications, the mRNA vaccines for COVID have very, very, very low rates of complications, lower than some other vaccines we've been using for decades. That's the peer-reviewed literature, in contrast to this hurried report, hurried because it needs to come to the ACIP for its meeting that begins on Wednesday. This hurried report by Kennedy's handpicked people. So, Brian, all I can say is that this is not the kind of science that anybody I know would pay any attention to.
It's the survey statistic they're glomming onto isn't even, did you experience side effects from COVID vaccination, which would be largely requiring non-professionals to make attributions of medical causality. It's saying, do you know someone? Have you heard of someone who had issues? It's just like a bizarre method for arriving at a kind of like useful figure, particularly in a poisoned media environment like we've had.
Yes, well, this is the world we're living in right now, where people have made up their minds about things and then they look for data or they create data to support them. I mean, we're hearing this all the time right now about the war that's going on. This is what's been coming out of the CDC and the FDA. And I suspect, although I'm not an expert in other governmental agencies, this is what's been coming out of the HHS since Robert Kennedy took over. So that's the world we live in now. We've got, on the one hand, science that has led us out of some very, very, very dark times. And on the other hand, we have ideologues who create their own data to support their feelings.
So I've only had time to like briefly skim the 60-page report coming out of this working group at Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. But it seems like what they're doing in their recommendations, they are asking for changes to the diagnostic coding and the like research resources for vaccine injury from COVID vaccines, and they are always doing it in the same breath with long COVID. Like they're trying to link the two phenomenon, which seems politically like an interesting maneuver. What do you make of it?
Well, it is politically very interesting because this is one of the steps they're taking to ultimately get the vaccine court, the court that's been functioning since, I believe, in the early 80s, to adjudicate people who believe they've been injured by vaccines. If they can get documentation, even though it's based upon falsehoods, if they can get documentation that there is a diagnosis of post-vaccine, post-COVID vaccine damage to people, this would be a step to get the vaccine courts to take these cases on. If that happens, the vaccine courts will stop functioning. This is something that's been well thought out, just like Project 2025 was well thought out, in nefarious ways, of course, but well thought out. And what Kennedy is doing is a well thought out process to really get people not to get vaccinated. And he's doing everything he can to accomplish that.
Dr. Schwartzberg, I should pause to open the phone lines because this is pretty much the only news development I had to discuss with you. We're speaking to Dr. John Schwartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health, and he is here to principally answer your questions, 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. There is a big question mark hanging over this meeting of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices that is scheduled for Wednesday, because apparently there is a lawsuit challenging the eligibility of the Robert F. Kennedy Jr. appointees to that committee to serve on it, their qualifications, that may get decided by a judge before Wednesday.
Yeah, we anticipate that the judge is going to come out with the decision sometime before Wednesday. That is either today or tomorrow. I'll be Needless to say, I, along with lots of other people, will be very interested in what happens with that. Essentially, what the lawsuit is arguing is that Kennedy is, as I think most of your listeners know, Kennedy fired in June all the members of the ACIP, all the members who were quite qualified to be in that position, and replaced them with people who are completely unqualified. And I'm being generous when I say they're unqualified. They're a lot worse. Many are a lot worse than that. And the challenge is to Kennedy is that you've put together a group of people that cannot advise the ACIP because they are not qualified to do that. I don't know how the judge is going to, obviously, I don't know how the judge will come down on this, but I think the lawsuit has merit from the perspective that certainly the almost all, not all, but almost all of the members of the ACIP are not qualified to be in the position they are in.
It would certainly be an interesting political development if a judge suddenly tossed out all of the people who Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had installed. It does kind of raise the question, what's lost from that entity? Not from the harms it's doing, but like from the things it's not getting to that it would have been working on under more normal circumstances.
Yeah, well, I think that when people look at the lives saved, the hospitalizations prevented, the ER visits prevented by vaccines, to a large extent, they can thank the members of the ACIP, the past members of the ACIP. I see that because the ACIP has, up until Kennedy, been populated with some of the top thinkers, top scientists, top people in this country who understand and have worked with vaccines their entire lives. And they've advised the CDC, and they've really been able to steer the CDC ship in a direction that has been enormously beneficial to the health of Americans. And that's what's been lost, Brian. And it's, of course, not just the ACIP. We're seeing this happen in other parts of our government now, but it's an enormous loss. When this nightmare is over, the damage is going to percolate through another generation. And that's what's so sad.
All right, let's go to listener calls at 1-800-958-9008. That is the number for your questions for Dr. Swartzberg, 1-800-958-9008. First from Half Moon Bay, we have Charlie. Good morning.
Good morning. Just a quick comment. I have a elementary school age child. She came down with COVID, and the advice from the school was, as long as she didn't have a fever, that it would be suitable for her to go in positive with a positive COVID test. And I just wanted to put that out there for your commentary, if you what your sense is of as far as practice goes. Thank you.
As long as she didn't have a fever, or after her fever had been resolved for 5 days.
As long as she didn't have a fever was the statement from them.
Wow, Dr. Swartzberg.
Well, I think what Charlie's question is about is the confusion that surrounds how to prevent transmission of COVID, how long to keep somebody in isolation. The recommendations, it's pretty standard recommendations, are for the 5 days following the diagnosis of COVID or following symptoms when COVID began. If fever has been gone for 24 hours at that point, at least 24 hours, and that's without using any medications like aspirin or Tylenol to lower the fever, then you can resume activities. It's also strongly suggested that you should be away from people who are immunocompromised or others who would have a bad time if they had COVID because of underlying health conditions, and be more cautious by wearing a good fitting mask if you're going to be around those folks. But from a school perspective, typically it's you can return when you haven't had fever for at least 24 hours. And it should be roughly about 5 days in most circumstances before your symptoms have markedly improved.
Is the first time I've heard of, I'm not a parent. I'm not very plugged into school policies. It's the first time I've heard of a school saying send your kid in if they've got a positive test and no fever. As a matter of policy, Dr. Swartzberg, does that sound to you like a school official who got, misunderstood the policy, or is this what schools are actually doing?
I don't know what schools are actually doing right now. And I think, I suspect, given what I knew a lot about during the height of the pandemic, I suspect that a lot of schools have different policies. What Charlie's bringing up is a question of public health policy versus what's best from an individual standpoint. And it makes most sense from an individual standpoint that if you're still testing positive and you're still coughing and sneezing, you should stay away from other people and not come to school. But from a public health policy that encompasses a large community or a state or a country, you can't have individuated policies like that. So we have general policies that will work most of the time. I know that's not a ideal answer, but from a policy standpoint, you're just not going to be able to drill down and pick every scenario out. So it really requires individual judgment on people's part.
Well, I guess work for what and for whom is part of the question. I mean, it seems like part of the issue in this country, and we really saw this with the strains that came out around school policies towards the end of the lockdown era, was we have a lousy safety net. We don't have automatic time off for parents who need to stay home with sick kids. We don't have social supports for families that might be losing income because they're isolating to keep from spreading a bug. Schools are one of our few universal institutions, and a lot of stuff lands on them, including like handling people with infectious diseases that might not in a country with a more robust safety net and set of social supports.
Absolutely. One of the safety supports that was really brought to the fore during the height of the pandemic was this is where a lot of kids got meals. That was their resource for meals. The battle over schools and how it was handled during the pandemic is going to continue. And there should be a robust dialogue about this and what we should learn from that. But your point, Brian, I think is the key. When we compare the United States to other countries, like people have been doing, other countries that are co of comparable or even more wealth than the United States, we just don't have the social services to help people. And if we had those, we would be in much better shape, including much better shape in terms of schools. So, not just meals, but socialization is terribly important. So you want to get kids back there. And of course, we want to get education for the kids. But how many kids really have the ability to be on Zoom, have computer access, et cetera? So there are lots of problems here in the US that were obviated by a society that has social supports.
All right, 1-800-958-9008 to put a question to Dr. John Swartzberg. 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. We should touch briefly on the trend lines, Dr. Swartzberg. Normally, we would be expecting this to be the very tail end of cold and flu season. It is now cold, flu, RSV, and sometimes COVID season. How are the trend lines on the charts looking to you? How cautious are you being when you're out and about?
Got it. Overall, good. Let's start with influenza. Influenza A was the gorilla in the room for the first part of the influenza season. It's been replaced, as it does most every year, with influenza B. Influenza B, the good news is it tends to be a little less severe for older people than influenza A. The bad news is that influenza B is more severe for very young children and young children. And unfortunately, we're seeing the consequences of that. We're now up to over 100 young children who've lost their lives to influenza this year. That number is going to continue to go up as a lot of the cases are looked at. Last year, the last influenza season we had, as I recall, close to 300 deaths. I don't know how many we'll have this year. We're roughly at the same place last week as we were a year ago last week. So tragically, we're going to see more deaths, and a lot of those are going to be in children, and almost all of those are in children who are not vaccinated. So influenza B is still around, but the good news is that in the United States, we're seeing it coming down now. We're at roughly about 3.9 influenza-like illness visits, and the threshold for the season being over is around 3.1%. So we're getting there. The even better news is that in California, our numbers are even lower. So that's very nice to see. In terms of COVID, it's been a very, very mild winter. It's the mildest we've had since the pandemic began 6 years ago, 6 plus years ago. And California has a the West in general is very low, the lowest in the United States, and California is one of the lowest, if not the lowest, in the West. So COVID is still around, but it's not an enormous problem at this point. And then RSV is the one exception to the good news with influenza and the very good news with COVID. RSV continues to be a problem. It's a late season for RSV. Typically, it's come down by this time, actually by later February, it's starting to come down. And we're still seeing an awful lot of RSV circulating, including here in California. So RSV is still out there, and it's not too late to protect yourself with the RSV vaccine. So keep that in mind. By the way, the RS vaccine just less than a week ago was now approved by the FDA for people 18 to 45, 49, if they have underlying conditions that would put them in position to have a bad episode with RSV. So now anybody over 18 should avail themselves of the vaccine if they are at higher risk, and anybody over 75, even if they're not at higher risk for other reasons, should be vaccinated. So RSV continues to be a problem.
What would be
One,
examples of those underlying conditions?
diabetes, chronic lung disease, obesity, any immunocompromised state. So it's a pretty large category.
In terms of preventing RSV spread, what do we know about non-pharmaceutical interventions? Is it the same playbook as COVID, masking and hand washing?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same playbook. Exactly. So you asked how cautious should people be? Certainly, if you're at increased risk for disease, you should be more cautious, whether it's from RSV, influenza, or COVID. Think harm reduction. So if you're going to be in an enclosed area with lots of people, perhaps riding on BART, why not just reduce your risk of these respiratory pathogens? Wear a mask. You and I have talked about over the last 6 years, Brian, that people in Asia do this, have been doing this for a long time, long before COVID. And those simple things really reduce your risk considerably.
All right. Dr. Schwartzberg, we'll leave it there for this week. Thank you so much for spending another Monday with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information's useful to a lot of people, and we ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. If you
You'd
can
like to
help
have
us
some.
get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.